Disk 4.
I'll keep working on the other screens. Thanks. What would I do without you? I said. I looked at McGovern as I hung up, and I told her what Cooper had just said. She was dead before the fire, I explained. Her cause of death, exsanguination and asphyxia due to aspiration of blood due to acute neck injury. As for manner, I'm pending that until further investigation, but I think we should work this as a homicide. In the meantime, we need to get her identified, and I'll do what I can to get started on that. I guess I'm supposed to imagine that this woman torched the place and maybe cut her own throat before the fire got her first, she said, as anger flickered. I did not answer as I measured coffee for the coffee maker on a nearby countertop. Don't you think that's rather far-fetched? She went on. I poured in bottled water and pressed a button. Kay, no one's going to want to hear homicide, she said, because of Kenneth Sparks and what all of this may imply. I hope you realize what you're up against. And what ATF is up against, I said, sitting across my hopelessly piled desk from her. Look, I don't care who he is, she replied. I do every job like I fully intend to make an arrest. I'm not the one who has to deal with the politics around here. But my mind wasn't on the media or Sparks right now. I was thinking that this case disturbed me at a deeper level and in ways I could not fathom. How much longer will your guys be at the scene? I asked her. Another day? Two at the most, she said. Sparks has supplied us and the insurance company with what was inside his house, and just the antique furniture and old wood flooring and paneling alone were a massive fuel load. What about the master bath? I asked, saying this was the point of origin. She hesitated. Obviously, that's the problem. Right. If an accelerant wasn't used, or at least not a petroleum distillate, then how? The guys are beating their brains out, she said, and she was frustrated. And so am I. If I try to predict how much energy would be needed in that room for a flashover condition, the fuel load isn't there. According to Sparks, there was nothing but a throw rug and towels. Cabinets and fixtures were customized brushed steel. The shower had a glass door, the window had sheer curtains. She paused as the coffee maker gurgled. So what are we talking about? She went on. 500-600 kilowatts total for a 10-by-15-foot room? Clearly there are other variables, such as how much air was flowing through the doorway. What about the rest of the house? You just said there was a big fuel load there, right? We're only concerned with one room, Kay, and that's the room of origin. Without an origin, the rest of the fuel load doesn't matter. I see. I know a flame was impinged on the ceiling in that bathroom, and I know how high that flame had to be and how many kilowatts of energy were needed for flashover. And a throw rug and maybe some towels and curtains couldn't even come close to causing something like that. I knew her engineering equations were pristinely mathematical, and I did not doubt anything she was saying, but it did not matter. I was still left with the same problem. I had reason to believe that we were dealing with a homicide, and that when the fire started, the victim's body was inside the master bath with its non-combustible marble floors, large mirrors, and steel. Indeed, she may have been in the tub. What about the open skylight? I asked McGovern. Does that fit with your theory? It could, because once again the flames had to be high enough to break the glass, and then heat would have vented through the opening like a chimney. Every fire has its own personality, but certain behaviors are always the same because they conform to the laws of physics. I understand. There are four stages, she went on, as if I knew nothing. First is the fire plume, or column of hot gases, flames, and smoke rising from the fire. That would have been the case, let's say, if the throw rug in the bathroom had ignited. The higher above the flame the gases rise, the cooler and denser they become. They mix with combustion byproducts, and the hot gases now begin to fall, and the cycle repeats itself, creating turbulent smoke that spreads horizontally. What should have happened next was this hot, smoky layer would have continued to descend until it found an opening for ventilation. In this case, we'll assume the bathroom doorway. Next, the smoky layer flows out of the opening while fresh air flows in. If there's enough oxygen, the temperature at the ceiling's going to go up to more than 600 degrees Celsius, and boom, we have flashover, or a fully developed fire. A fully developed fire in the master bath, I said. and then on into other oxygen-enriched rooms where the fuel loads were enough to burn the place to the ground, she replied. So it's not the spread of the fire that bothers me. It's how it got started. Like I said, a throw rug, curtains weren't enough, unless something else was there. Maybe something was, I said, getting up to pour coffee. How do you take yours? I asked. Cream and sugar. Her eyes followed me. None of that artificial stuff, please. I drank mine black and set mugs on the desk as McGovern's gaze wandered around my new office. Certainly it was brighter and more modern than what I had occupied in the old building on 14th and Franklin, but I really had no more room to evolve. Worst of all, I had been honored with a CEO corner space with windows, and anybody who understood physicians knew that what we needed were walls for bookcases and not bulletproof glass overlooking a parking lot and the Petersburg Turnpike. My hundreds of medical, legal, and forensic science reviews, journals, and formidable volumes were crammed together and in some cases double-shelved. It was not uncommon for Rose, my secretary, to hear me swearing when I could not find a reference book I needed right that minute. Tien, I said, sipping my coffee, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for taking care of Lucy. Lucy takes care of herself, she said. That has not always been true. I smiled in an effort to be more gracious, to hide the hurt and jealousy that were a splinter in my heart. But you're right, I said. I think she does a pretty admirable job of it now. I'm sure Philadelphia will be good for her. McGovern was reading every signal I was sending, and I could tell she was aware of more than I wanted her to be. Kay, hers will not be an easy road, she then stated, no matter what I do. She swirled the coffee in her mug, as if about to taste the first sip of fine wine. I'm her supervisor, not her mother, McGovern said. This irked me considerably, and it showed when I abruptly picked up the phone and instructed Rose to hold all calls. I got up and shut my door. I would hope she's not transferring to your field office because she needs a mother, I coolly replied as I returned to my desk, which served as a barrier between us. Above all else, Lucy is a consummate professional. McGovern held up her hand to stop me. Whoa, she protested. Of course she is. I'm just not promising anything. She's a big girl, but she's also got a lot of big obstacles. Her FBI background will be held against her by some who will assume right off the bat that she has an attitude and has never really worked cases. That stereotype shouldn't last long, I said, and I was finding it very difficult to objectively discuss my niece with her. Oh, about as long as it takes for them to see her land a helicopter or program a robot to remove a bomb from a scene, she quipped. Or zip through Q-dot calculations in her head, while the rest of us can't even figure them out on a calculator. Q-dot was slang for the mathematical equations or scientific evaluations used to estimate the physics and chemistry of a fire as it related to what the investigator observed at the scene or was told by witnesses. I wasn't sure Lucy would make many friends by being able to work such esoteric formulas in her head. Tien, I said, softening my tone. Lucy's different, and that isn't always good. In fact, in many ways, it is just as much a handicap to be a genius as it is to be retarded. Absolutely. I am more aware of this than you might imagine. As long as you understand, I said, as if I were reluctantly handing her the baton in the relay race of Lucy's difficult development. And as long as you understand that she has and will continue to be treated like everybody else, which includes the other agent's reactions to her baggage, which includes rumors about why she left the FBI and about her alleged personal life, she frankly stated. I looked at her long and hard, wondering just how much she really knew about Lucy. Unless McGovern had been briefed by someone at the Bureau, there was no reason I could think of why she should know about my niece's affair with Carrie Grethen and the implications of what that might mean when the case went to court, assuming Carrie was caught. Just the reminder cast a shadow over what had already been a dark day, and my uncomfortable silence invited McGovern to fill it. I have a son, she quietly stated, staring into her coffee. I know what it's like to have children grow up and suddenly vanish, go their own way, too busy to visit or get on the phone? Lucy grew up a long time ago, I quickly said, for I did not want her to commiserate with me. She also never lived with me, not permanently, I mean. In a way, she's always been gone. But McGovern just smiled as she got out of her chair. I've got troops to check on, she said. I guess I'd better be on my way. 6. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, my staff was still busy in the autopsy room, and I walked in looking for Chuck. He and two of my residents were working on the burned woman's body, defleshing her as best they could with plastic spatulas, because anything harder might scratch the bones. Chuck was sweating beneath his surgical cap and mask as he scraped tissue from the skull, his brown eyes rather glazed behind his face shield. He was tall and wiry, with short, sandy blonde hair that tended to stick out in every direction, no matter how much gel he used. He was attractive in an adolescent way, and after a year on the job, still terrified of me. Chuck, I said again, inspecting one of the more ghoulish tasks in forensic medicine. Yes, ma'am. He stopped scraping and looked up furtively at me. The stench was getting worse by the minute, as unrefrigerated flesh continued to decompose, and I was not looking forward to what I needed to do next. Let me just check this one more time, I said to Ruffin, who was so tall he tended to stoop, his neck jutting out like a turtle when he looked at whoever he was talking to. Our old battered pots and pans didn't make it in the move. I think somehow they got tossed out, he said. And probably should have, I told him. Which means you and I have an errand to run. Now? Now. He wasted no time heading into the men's locker room to get out of his dirty, stinking scrubs and shower just long enough to get the shampoo out of his hair. He was still perspiring, his face pink from scrubbing, when we met in the corridor, and I handed him a set of keys. The dark red office Tahoe was parked inside the bay, and I climbed up into the passenger's seat, letting Ruffin drive. We're going to Cole's Restaurant Supply, I told him as the big engine came to life. About 2 blocks west of Parham, on Broad. Just get us on 64 and take the West Broad exit. I'll show you from there. He pushed a remote control on the visor and the bay door heavily rolled up, letting in sunlight that I had not noticed all day. Rush hour traffic had just begun and would be awful in another half hour. Ruffin drove like an old woman, dark glasses on and hunched forward as he kept his speed about 5 miles an hour less than the limit. You can go a little faster, I calmly told him. It closes at 5, so we sort of need to hurry along. He stepped on the gas, lurching us forward, and fumbled in the ashtray for toll tokens. You mind if I ask you something, Dr. Scarpetta? He said. Please, go right ahead. It's kind of bizarre. He glanced in the rearview mirror again. That's all right. You know, I've seen a lot of things, at the hospital and the funeral home and all, he nervously began. And nothing got to me, you know? He slowed at the toll plaza and tossed a token into the basket. The red-striped arm went up, and we rolled on as people in a hurry darted past us. Ruffin rolled his window back up. It's normal for what you're seeing now to get to you, I finished his thought for him, or thought I did. But this was not what he wanted to tell me. You see, most of the time I get to the morgue before you in the morning, he said instead, his eyes riveted forward as he drove. So I'm the one who answers the phones and gets things ready for you, right? You know, because I'm there alone. I nodded, having not a clue as to what he was about to say. Well, starting about 2 months ago, when we were still in the old building, the phone started ringing at about 6:30 in the morning, just after I got in. And when I would pick it up, nobody was there. How often has this happened? I asked. Maybe 3 times a week? Sometimes every day? And it's still happening. He was getting my attention now. It's happening since we moved. I wanted to make sure. Of course, we have the same number, he reminded me. But yes, ma'am. In fact, it happened again this morning, and I've started getting a little spooked. I'm just wondering if we should try to get the calls traced to see what's going on. Tell me exactly what happens when you pick up the phone, I said, as we drove exactly at the speed limit along the interstate. I say morgue, he said, and whoever it is doesn't say a word. There's silence, almost like the line is dead, so I say hello a few times and finally hang up. I can tell there's someone there. It's just something I sense. Why haven't you told me this before? I wanted to make sure it wasn't just me overreacting, or maybe being too imaginative, because I got to tell you it's kind of creepy in there first thing in the morning when the sun's not up yet and no one else is around. And you say this started about 2 months ago? More or less, he answered. I didn't really count the first few, you know. I was irritated that he had waited until now to pass this along to me, but there was no point in belaboring that. I'll pass this along to Captain Marino, I said. In the meantime, Chuck, you need to tell me if this happens again, okay? He nodded, his knuckles white on the steering wheel. Just beyond the next light, we're looking for a big beige building. It will be on our left in the 9000 block, just past Jopa's. Cole's was 15 minutes from closing, and there were but two other cars in the lot when we parked. Ruffin and I got out, and air conditioning was frigid as we entered a wide open space with aisles of metal shelves all the way up to the ceiling. Crowded on them was everything from restaurant-sized ladles and spoons to food warmers for cafeteria lines to giant coffee makers and mixers. But it was potware that I was interested in, and after a quick scan I found the section I needed, halfway to the back, near electric skillets and measuring cups. I began lifting great aluminum pans and pots when a sales clerk suddenly appeared. He was balding and big-bellied, and sporting a tattoo of naked women playing cards on his right forearm. "Can I help you?" he said to Ruffin. "I need the biggest cooking pot you've got," I answered. "That'd be 40 quarts." He reached up to a shelf too high for me and handed the monstrous pot to Ruffin. "I'll need a lid," I said. "Will have to be ordered." "What about something deep and rectangular?" I then said, as I envisioned long bones. "Got a 20-quart pan?" He reached up to another shelf, and metal clanged as he lifted out a pan that had probably been intended for vats of whipped potatoes, vegetables, or cobbler. "And I don't suppose you have a lid for that either," I said. "Yeah." Different-sized lids clattered as he pulled one out. "It's got the notch right here for the ladle. I guess you'll be wanting a ladle, too." "No, thank you," I said. "Just something long to stir with, either wooden or plastic. And heat-resistant gloves, 2 pairs. What else?" I looked at Ruffin as I thought. "Maybe we should get a 20-quart pot, too, for smaller jobs," I mused. "That'd be a good idea," he agreed. "That big pot's going to be mighty heavy when it's filled with water. And there's no point in using it if something smaller will work, but I think you're going to need the bigger pot this time or it all won't fit, you know?" The salesman was getting more confused as he listened to our evasive conversation. "You tell me what you're planning to cook, and maybe I can give you some advice," he offered, again to Ruffin. "Different things," I replied. "Mostly I'll be boiling things." "Oh, I see," he said, even though he didn't. "Well, will there be anything else?" "That's it," I answered him with a smile. At the counter, he rang up $177 of restaurant cookware while I got out my billfold and hunted for my MasterCard. "Do you by chance give discounts to state government?" I asked as he took my card from me. "No," he said, rubbing his double chin as he frowned at my card. "I think I've heard your name on the news before." He stared suspiciously at me. "I know," he snapped his fingers. "You're the lady who ran for the Senate a few years back. Or maybe it was for Lieutenant Governor," he said, pleased. "Not me," I answered. "I try to stay out of politics." "You and me both," he loudly said as Ruffin and I carried our purchases out the door. "They're all crooks, every single one of them." When we returned to the morgue, I gave Ruffin instructions to remove the remains of the burn victim from the refrigerator and wheel them and the new pots into the decomposition room. I shuffled through telephone messages, most of them from reporters, and realized I was nervously pulling at my hair when Rose appeared in the doorway that joined my office to hers. "You look like you've had a bad day," she said. "No worse than usual. How about a cup of cinnamon tea?" "I don't think so," I said, "but thanks." Rose placed a stack of death certificates on my desk, adding to the never-ending pile of documents for me to initial or sign. She was dressed this day in a smart navy blue pantsuit and bright purple blouse, her shoes typically black leather lace-ups for walking. Rose was well past retirement age, although it didn't show in her face, which was regal and subtly made up. But her hair had gotten finer and had turned completely white, while arthritis nibbled at her fingers, lower back, and hips, making it increasingly uncomfortable for her to sit at her desk and take care of me, as she had from my first day at this job. "It's almost 6," she said, looking kindly at me. I glanced up at the clock as I began to scan paperwork and sign my name. "I have a dinner at the church," she diplomatically let me know. "That's nice," I said, frowning as I read. "Damn it! How many times do I have to tell Dr. Carmichael that you don't sign out a death as cardiac arrest? Jesus, everybody dies of cardiac arrest. You die, your heart quits, right? And he's done the respiratory arrest number 2, no matter how many times I've amended his certificates." I sighed in annoyance. "He's been the ME in Halifax County for how many years?" I continued my tirade. 25 at least?" "Dr. Scarpetta, don't forget, he's an obstetrician, and an ancient one at that," Rose reminded me. "A nice man who's not capable of learning anything new. He still types his reports on an old manual royal, flying capitals and all. And the reason I mentioned the church dinner is I'm supposed to be there in 10 minutes. She paused, regarding me over her reading glasses. "But I can stay if you want me to," she added. "I've got some things to do," I told her. "And the last thing I would think of is to interfere with a church dinner, yours or anyone's. I'm always in enough trouble with God as is." "Then I'll say goodnight," Rose said. "My dictations are in your basket. I'll see you in the morning." After her footsteps vanished down the corridor, I was enveloped by silence, broken only by the sounds of paper I was moving around on my desk. I thought of Benton several times and warded off my desire to call him because I was not ready to relax, or maybe I simply did not want to feel human quite yet. It was, after all, hard to feel like a normal person with normal emotions when one is about to boil human remains in what is essentially a large soup pot. A few minutes after 7, I followed the corridor to the decomposition room, which was 2 doors down and across from the cooler. I unlocked the door and entered what was nothing more than a small autopsy room with a freezer and special ventilation. The remains were covered by a sheet on a transportable table, a new 40-quart pot filled with water on an electric burner beneath a chemical hood. I put on a mask and gloves and turned the burner on a low heat that would not further damage the bones. I poured in 2 scoops of laundry detergent and a cup of bleach to hasten the loosening of fibrous membranes, cartilage, and grease. I opened the sheets, exposing bones stripped of most of their tissue, the extremities pitifully truncated like burned sticks. I gently placed femurs and tibias into the pot, then the pelvis and parts of the skull. Vertebrae and ribs followed as water got hotter and a sharp-smelling steam began to rise. I needed to see her bare, clean bones because they might have something to tell me, and there simply was no other way to do it. For a while I sat in that room, the hood loudly sucking up air as I drifted in my chair. I was tired. I was emotionally drained and feeling all alone. Water heated up, and what was left of a woman I believed had been murdered began to process in the pot, in what seemed one more indignity and callous slight to who she was. "Oh, God," I sighed, as if God might somehow hear me. "Bless her, wherever she is." It was hard to imagine being reduced to bones cooking in a pot, and the more I thought about it, the more depressed I got. Somewhere, someone had loved this woman, and she had accomplished something in this life before her body and identity had been so cruelly stripped away. I had spent my existence trying to ward off hate, but by now it was too late. It was true that I hated sadistic, evil people whose purpose in life was to torment life and take it, as if it were theirs to appropriate. It was true that executions deeply disturbed me, but only because they resurrected heartless crimes and the victims society barely remembered. Steam rose in a hot, moist vapor, tainting the air with a nauseating stench that would lessen the longer the bones were processed. I envisioned someone thin and tall and blonde, someone wearing jeans and lace-up boots, with a platinum ring tucked in her back pocket. Her hands were gone, and I probably would never know the size of her fingers or if the ring had fit, but it wasn't likely. Fielding probably was right, and I knew I had one more thing to ask Sparks. I thought of her wounds and tried to reconstruct how she might have gotten them and why her fully clothed body had been in the master bathroom. That location, if we were correct about it, was unexpected and odd. Her jeans had not been undone, for when I had recovered the zipper, it had been zipped shut, and certainly her buttocks had been covered. Based on the synthetic fabric that had melted into her flesh, I also had no reason to suspect that her breasts had been exposed. Not that any of these findings ruled out a sexual assault, but they certainly argued against one. I was checking the bones through a veil of steam when the telephone rang, startling me. At first I thought it might be some funeral home with a body to deliver, but then I realized that the flashing light was one of the lines for the autopsy room. I could not help but remember what Ruffin had said about spooky early morning calls, and I halfway expected to hear no one on the other end. "Yes," I abruptly said.
"Jeez, who pissed in your cornflakes?" Marino answered back.
"Oh," I said, relieved. "Sorry, I thought it was someone playing pranks."
"What do you mean, pranks?"
"Later," I said. "What's going on?"
"I'm sitting in your parking lot and was hoping you might let me in."
"I'll be right there." In fact, I was very pleased to have company. I hurried to the enclosed bay and I pushed a button on a wall. The huge door began to crank up, and Marino ducked under it, the dark night smudged with sodium vapor lights. I realized the sky had gotten overcast with clouds that portended rain.
"Why are you here so late?" Marino asked in his usual grumpy way as he sucked on a cigarette.
"My office is smoke-free," I reminded him.
"Like anybody in this joint's gotta worry about secondary smoke."
"A few of us are still breathing," I said. He flicked the cigarette to the concrete floor and irritably crushed it with his foot, as if we had never been through this routine, not even once in our lives. In fact, this had gotten to be a standard act with us that in its own dysfunctional way somehow reaffirmed our bond to each other. I was quite certain that Marino's feelings would be injured if I didn't nag him about something. "You can follow me into the decomp room," I said to him as I shut the bay door. "I'm in the middle of something."
"I wish I'd known before," he complained. "I would have just dealt with you over the phone."
"Don't worry, it's not too bad. I'm just cleaning up some bones."
"Maybe that ain't bad to you," he said, "but I've never gotten used to smelling people cook."
We walked inside the decomposition room and I handed him a surgical mask. I checked the processing to see how it was going and turned the heat down 50 degrees to make sure the water did not boil and knock bones against each other and the sides of the pot. Marino bent the mask to fit over his nose and mouth and tied sloppy bows in the back. He spotted a box of disposable gloves, snatched a pair, and worked them on. It was ironical that he was obsessive in his concerns about outside agents invading his health, when in fact the gravest danger was simply the way he lived. He was sweating in khakis and a white shirt and tie, and at some point during the day had been assaulted by ketchup.
"Got a couple interesting things for you, Doc," he said, leaning against a brightly polished sink. "We ran the tags on the burned-up Mercedes behind Kenneth Sparks' house, and it comes back to an 81 Benz 240D, blue. The odometer's probably rolled over at least twice. Registration's a little scary. Comes back to a Dr. Newton Joyce in Wilmington, North Carolina.
He's in the book, but I couldn't get him, just his answering machine. Wilmington is where Claire Raleigh went to school, and close to where Sparks had his beach house, I reminded him.
Right. So far the signs are still pointing that way.
He stared blankly at the steaming pot on the burner.
She drives someone else's car to Warrenton and somehow gets inside the Sparks house when he's not home and gets murdered and burns up in a fire, he said, rubbing his temples. I tell you, this one stinks about as bad as what you're cooking there, Doc. We're missing a really big piece because nothing's making sense.
Are there any Raleighs in the Wilmington area? I asked. Any possibility she has relatives there?
They got two listings, and neither of them have ever heard of a Raleigh named Claire, he said.
What about the university?
Haven't gotten to that yet, he answered as I went over to check the pot again. Thought you were going to do that.
In the morning.
So, you going to hang out here all night cooking this shit?
As a matter of fact, I said, turning off the burner, I'm going to let it sit so I can go home. What time is it anyway?
Oh, God, almost 9 o'clock, and I've got court in the morning. Let's blow this joint, he said. I locked the door to the decomposition room, and I opened the bay door again. Through it, I saw mountainous dark clouds blowing across the moon like boats in full sail, and the wind was wild and making eerie rushing sounds around the corners of my building. Marino walked me to my car and seemed in no hurry as he got out his cigarettes and lit one.
I don't want to put any hinky ideas in your head, he said, but there's something I think you ought to know.
I unlocked my car door and slid behind the wheel. I'm afraid to ask, I said, and I meant it.
I got a call about 4:30 this afternoon from Rex Willis at the paper, the editorial columnist, he said.
I know who he is. I fastened my seatbelt.
Apparently he got a letter today from an anonymous source, kind of in the format of a press release. It's pretty bad.
About what? I said, as an alarm shot through my blood.
Well, it's supposedly from Carrie Grethen, and she's saying that she escaped from Kirby because she was framed by the feds and knew they'd execute her for something she didn't do unless she got away. She claims that at the time of the murders you were having an affair with the chief profiler in the case, Benton Wesley, and all the so-called evidence against her was doctored, made up, a conspiracy between the two of you to make the Bureau look good.
And this was mailed from where? I asked, as outrage heated me up.
Manhattan.
And it was addressed specifically to Rex Willis?
Yep.
And, of course, he's not going to do anything with it. Marino hesitated.
Come on, Doc, he said. When's the last time a reporter didn't do something with something?
Oh, for God's sake, I blurted out as I started the engine. Has the media gone totally mad? They get a letter from a psycho and print it in the paper?
I've got a copy if you want to see it.
He dug a folded sheet of paper out of his back pocket and handed it to me.
It's a fax, he explained. The original's already at the lab. Documents is going to see what they can do with it.
I unfolded the copy with shaking hands and did not recognize the neat printing in black ink. It was nothing like the bizarre red printing that was on the letter I had received from Carrie, and in this epistle the words were very articulate and clear. For a moment I read, skimming over the ridiculous claims that she had been framed, my eyes stopping cold on the last long paragraph. As for Special Agent Lucy Farinelli, she has enjoyed a successful career only because the ever-influential Chief Medical Examiner, Dr. Scarpetta, her aunt, has covered up her niece's mistakes and transgressions for years. When Lucy and I were both at Quantico, it was she who came on to me, not the other way around, as it would most certainly be alleged in court. While it is true that we were lovers for a while, this was all manipulation on her part to get me to cover for her when she screwed up Kane time and time again. Then she went on to take credit for work she'd never done. I'm telling you this is the God's truth. I swear it. And I'm asking you to please print this letter for all to see. I don't want to stay in hiding the rest of my life, convicted by society for terrible deeds I did not do. My only hope for freedom and justice is for people to see the truth and do something about it. Have mercy. Carrie Grethen. Marino quietly smoked until I was finished reading. Then he said,
This person knows too much. I got no doubt the bitch wrote it.
She writes me a letter that seems the work of someone deranged and then follows it with this, something that seems completely rational, I said, and I was so upset I felt sick. How does that make sense, Marino?
He shrugged as the first drops of rain began to fall. I'll tell you what I think, he said. She was sending you a signal. She wants you to know she's jerking everybody around. It wouldn't be fun for her if she couldn't piss you off and ruin your day.
Does Benton know about this?
Not yet.
And you really think the paper's going to print it?
I asked again, hoping his answer would be different this time.
You know how it goes.
He dropped the cigarette butt, and it glowed to the ground and scattered in sparks.
The story will be that this notorious psychopathic killer has contacted them while half of law enforcement is out there looking for the bitch, he said. And the other bad news is that there's nothing to say she hasn't sent the same letter other places, too.
Poor Lucy, I muttered.
Yeah, well, poor everybody, Marino said.
7. Rain was slanted and flying down like nails as I made my way home, scarcely able to see. I had turned the radio off because I did not want to hear any more news this day, and I was certain this would be one night when I was too keyed up to sleep. Twice I slowed to 30 miles an hour as my heavy Mercedes sedan splashed through water like a cigarette boat. On West Carey Street, dips and potholes were filled like tubs, and emergency lights streaking red and blue through the downpour reminded me to take my time. It was almost 10 o'clock when I finally pulled into my driveway, and a note of fear was plucked in my heart when motion sensor lights did not come on near the garage door. The darkness was complete, with only the rumble of my car engine and drumming of rain to orient my senses as to what world I was in. For a moment I deliberated about opening the garage door or speeding away. This is ridiculous, I said to myself, as I pressed a button on the visor. But the door did not respond.
Damn!
I shifted the car into reverse and backed up without being able to see the driveway or brick border or even the shrubbery for that matter. The tree I swiped was small and did no harm, but I felt sure I had churned up part of the lawn as I maneuvered to the front of my house, where timers inside had at least turned lamps on and the light in the foyer. As for motion sensor lights on either side of the front steps, they were out too. I reasonably told myself that the weather had caused a power outage earlier in the evening, causing a circuit breaker to be thrown. Rain swept into my car as I opened the door. I grabbed my pocketbook and briefcase and bolted up the front steps. I was soaked to the skin by the time I unlocked the front door, and the silence that greeted me thrilled me with fear. Lights dancing across the keypad by the door meant the burglar alarm had gone off, or perhaps an electrical surge had screwed that up too. But it did not matter. By now I was terrified and afraid to move. So I stood in the foyer, water dripping on the hardwood floor as my brain raced to the nearest gun. I could not remember if I had returned the Glock to a drawer of the kitchen desk. That certainly would be closer than my office or bedroom, which were on the other side of the house. Stone walls and windows were buffeted by the wind and lashed by rain, and I strained to hear any other sounds, such as the creaking of an upstairs floor or feet on carpet. In a burst of panic, I suddenly dropped my briefcase and pocketbook from my hands and ran through the dining room and into the kitchen, my wet feet almost going out from under me. I yanked open the bottom right drawer in the desk and almost cried out in relief when I grabbed my Glock. For a while, I searched my house again, flipping on lights in every room. Satisfied that I had no unwanted guests, I checked the fuse box in the garbage and flipped on the breakers that had tripped. Order was restored, the alarm reset, and I poured a tumbler of Black Bush Irish whiskey on the rocks and waited for my nerves to tuck themselves back inside their sheaths. Then I called Johnson's Motel in Warrenton, but Lucy was not there. So I tried her apartment in D.C., and Janet answered the phone. "Hi, it's Kay," I said. "I hope I didn't wake anyone." "Oh, hello, Dr. Scarpetta," said Janet, who could not call me by my first name, no matter how many times I had told her to. "No, I'm just sitting here having a beer and waiting for Lucy." "I see," I said, very disappointed. She's on her way home from Warrington.
Not for long. You ought to see this place. Boxes everywhere. It's a wreck.
How are you holding up through all this, Janet?
I don't know yet, she said, and I detected a quiver in her voice.
It will be an adjustment. God knows we've been through adjustments before.
And I'm sure you'll get through this one with flying colors. I sipped my whiskey and had no faith in what I'd just said, but at the moment I was grateful to hear a warm human voice. When I was married, ancient years ago, Tony and I were on two totally different planes, I said. But we managed to find time for each other, quality time. In some ways it was better like that.
And you also got divorced, she politely pointed out.
Not at first.
Lucy won't be here for at least another hour, Dr. Scarpetta. Is there a message I can give her?
I hesitated, not sure what to do.
Is everything all right? Janet then asked.
Actually, no, I said. I guess you haven't heard. I guess she hasn't heard either, for that matter.
I gave her a quick summary of Carrie's letter to the press, and after I had finished, Janet was as silent as a cathedral.
I'm telling you because you'd better be prepared, I added. You could wake up tomorrow and see this in the paper. You might hear it on the late news tonight.
It's best you told me, Janet said so quietly I could barely hear her. And I'll let Lucy know when she gets in.
Tell her to call me if she's not too tired.
I'll tell her.
Good night, Janet.
No, it isn't. It isn't a good night at all, she said.
That bitch has been ruining our lives for years, one way or another, and I've fucking had enough of it, and I'm sorry to use that word.
I've said it before.
I was there, for God's sake, she began to cry. Carrie was all over her, the manipulative psycho bitch. Lucy never stood a chance. My God, she was just a kid, this genius kid who probably should have stayed in college where she belonged instead of doing an internship with the fucking Bureau of Investigation. Look, I'm still FBI, okay? But I see the shit, and they haven't done right by her, which just makes her all the more vulnerable to what Carrie is doing.
My whiskey was half gone, and there wasn't enough of it in the world to make me feel better right now.
She doesn't need to get upset either, Janet went on, in a gush of frankness about her lover that I had never before heard. I don't know if she's told you. In fact, I don't think she ever intended to. But Lucy's been seeing a psychiatrist for 2 years, Dr. Scarpetta.
Good. I'm glad to hear it, I said, disguising my hurt.
No, she hasn't told me, but I wouldn't necessarily expect her to, I added, with the perfect voice of objectivity, as the ache in my heart got more intense.
She's been suicidal, Janet said, more than once.
I'm glad she's seeing someone, was all I could think to say, as tears welled.
I was devastated. Why had Lucy not reached out to me?
Most of the great achievers have their very dark passages, I said. I'm just glad she's doing something about it.
Is she taking anything?
Wellbutrin. Prozac weirded her out. 1 minute a zombie and bar-hopping the next.
Oh, I could barely speak.
She doesn't need any more stress or upheavals or rejections, Janet went on. You don't know what it's like. Something knocks her off balance and she's down for weeks. Up and down, up and down. Morbid and miserable 1 minute and Mighty Mouse the next.
She placed her hand over the receiver and blew her nose. I wanted to know the name of Lucy's psychiatrist, but was afraid to ask. I wondered if my niece were bipolar and undiagnosed.
Dr. Scarpetta, I don't want her, she struggled, choking. I don't want her to die.
She won't, I said. I can promise you that.
We hung up and I sat for a while on my bed, still dressed and afraid to sleep because of the chaos inside my head. For a while I wept in fury and in pain. Lucy could hurt me more than anyone, and she knew it. She could bruise me to the bone and crush my heart, and what Janet had told me was by far the most devastating blow. I could not help but think of Tian McGovern's inquisitive mind when we had talked in my office, and she had seemed to know so much about Lucy's difficulties. Had Lucy told her and not me?
I waited for Lucy to call, and she didn't. Since I had not called Benton, at midnight he finally called me.
Kay?
Have you heard? I said with feeling. What Carrie has done?
I know about her letter.
Damn it, Benton! Damn it all!
I'm in New York,
he surprised me by saying. The bureaus called me in. Well, okay, and they should have. You know her.
Unfortunately.
I'm glad you're there, I decided out loud. Somehow it seems safer. Isn't that an ironical thing to say? Since when is New York safer?
You're very upset.
Do you know anything more about where she is?
I swirled melting ice in my glass. We know she mailed her latest letter from a 10036 zip code, which is Times Square. The post date is June 10th, yesterday, Tuesday.
The day she escaped?
Yes.
And we still don't know how she did that.
We still don't know, he said. It's as if she beamed herself across the river.
No, it's not like that, I said, weary and out of sorts. Someone saw something and someone probably helped her. She's always been skilled at getting people to do what she wants.
The profiling units had too many calls to count, he said. Apparently she did a blitz mailing, all the major newspapers, including the Post and the New York Times.
And?
And this is too juicy for them to drop in a basket, Kay. The hunt for her is as big as the one for the Unabomber or Cunanan, and now she's writing to the media. The story's gonna run. Hell, they'll print her grocery list and broadcast her belches. To them, she's gold. She's magazine covers and movies in the making.
I don't want to hear any more, I said.
I miss you.
You wouldn't if you were around me right now, Benton.
We said goodnight, and I fluffed the pillow behind my back and contemplated another whiskey, but thought better of it. I tried to imagine what Carrie would do, and the twisted path always led back to Lucy. Somehow that would be Carrie's tour de force because she was consumed by envy. Lucy was more gifted, more honorable, more everything, and Carrie would not rest until she had appropriated that fierce beauty and sucked up every drop of Lucy's life. It was becoming clear to me that Carrie did not even need to be present to do it. All of us were moving closer to her black hole, and the power of her pull was shockingly strong. My sleep was tortured, and I dreamed of plane crashes and sheets soaked with blood. I was in a car and then a train, and someone was chasing me. When I awakened at 6:30, the sun was announcing itself in a royal blue sky, and puddles gleamed in the grass. I carried my Glock into the bathroom, locked the door, and took a quick shower. When I shut the water off, I listened closely to make sure my burglar alarm wasn't going, and then I checked the keypad in my bedroom to make sure the system was still armed. All the while I was aware of how paranoid and downright irrational my behavior was, but I could not help it. I was scared. Suddenly Carrie was everywhere. She was the thin woman in sunglasses and baseball cap walking along my street, or the driver pulling up close behind me at the toll plaza, or the homeless woman in a shapeless coat who stared at me as I crossed Broad Street. She was anyone white with punk hair and body piercing, or anyone androgynous or oddly dressed, and all the while I kept telling myself I had not seen Carrie in more than 5 years. I had no idea what she looked like now, and quite possibly would not recognize her until it was too late. The bay door was open when I parked behind my office, and Bliley's funeral home was loading a body into the back of a shiny black hearse as the rhythm continued of bringing and taking away. "Pretty weather," I said to the attendant in his neat dark suit. "Fine, how are you?" came the reply of someone who no longer listened. Another well-dressed man climbed out to help, and stretcher legs clacked and the tailgate slammed shut. I waited for them to drive off, and I rolled down the big door after them. My first stop was Fielding's office. It was not quite 8:15.
"How are we doing?" I asked as I knocked on his door.
"Come in," he said.
He was scanning books on his shelves, his lab coat straining around his powerful shoulders. Life was difficult for my deputy chief, who rarely could find clothes that fit, since he basically had no waist or hips. I remembered our first company picnic at my house, when he had lounged in the sun with nothing but cutoffs on. I had been amazed and slightly embarrassed that I could scarcely take my eyes off him,
not because I had any thoughts of bed, but rather his raw physical beauty had briefly held me hostage. I could not comprehend how anyone could find time to look like that.
"I guess you've seen the paper," he said.
"The letter," I said as my mood sunk.
"Yes."
He slid out an outdated PDR and set it on the floor.
"Front page with a photo of you and an old mug shot of her." "I'm sorry you have to put up with shit like this," he said, hunting for other books. "The phones up front are going crazy."
"What have we got this morning?" I changed the subject.
"Last night's car wreck from Midlothian Turnpike, passenger and driver killed. Their views and DeMaio's already started on them. Other than that, nothing else."
"That's enough," I said. "I've got court."
"Thought you were on vacation."
"So did I."
"Seriously, didn't get it continued."
"What,
you were gonna have to come back from Hilton Head?"
"Judge Bowles."
"Huh," Fielding said with disgust. "He's done this to you how many times now? I think he waits to find out your void date so he can decide on a court date that will totally screw you. Then what? He bust your butt to get back here, and half the time he continues the case."
"I'm on the pager," I said.
"And you can guess what I'll be doing."
He pointed at the paperwork cascading from piles on his desk.
"I'm so behind, I need a rear-view mirror," he quipped.
"There's no point in nagging you," I said. The John Marshall Courts building was but a 10-minute walk from our new location, and I thought the exercise would do me good. The morning was bright, the air cool and clean, as I followed the sidewalk along Lee Street and turned south on 9th, passing police headquarters, my pocketbook over my shoulder and an accordion file tucked under an arm. This morning's case was the mundane result of one drug dealer killing another, and I was surprised to see at least a dozen reporters on the third floor outside the courtroom door. At first I thought Rose had made a mistake on my schedule, for it never occurred to me that the media might have been there for me. But the minute I was spotted, they hurried my way with television cameras shouldered, microphones pointed, and flash guns going off. At first I was startled, then I was angry.
"Dr. Scarpetta, what is your response to Carrie Grethen's letter?" asked a reporter from Channel 6.
"No comment," I said, as I frantically cast about for the Commonwealth's attorney who had summoned me here to testify in his case.
"What about the conspiracy allegation?"
"Between you and your FBI lover?"
"That would be Benton Wesley. What is your niece's reaction?"
I shoved past a cameraman, my nerves hopping like faulty wiring as my heart flew. I shut myself inside the small windowless witness room and sat in a wooden chair. I felt trapped and foolish, and wondered how I could have been so thick as to not consider that something like this might happen after what Carrie had done. I opened the accordion file and began going through various reports and diagrams, envisioning gunshot entrances and exits, and which had been fatal. I stayed in my airless space for almost half an hour until the Commonwealth's attorney found me. We spoke for several minutes before I took the stand. What ensued brought to fruition what had happened in the hallway moments before, and I found myself disassociating from the core of myself to survive what was nothing more than a ruthless attack.
"Dr. Scarpetta," said defense attorney Will Lampkin, who had been trying to get the best of me for years. "How many times have you testified in this court?"
"I object," said the CA.
"Overruled," said Judge Bowles, my fan.
"I've never counted," I replied.
"But surely you can give us an estimate. More than a dozen? More than 100? 1,000,000?
"More than 100," I said, as I felt his lust for blood.
"And you have always told the truth to the juries and the judges?"
Lampkin slowly paced, a pious expression on his florid face, hands clamped behind his back.
"I have always told the truth," I answered.
"And you don't consider it somewhat dishonest, Dr. Scarpetta, to sleep with the FBI?"
"I object!" The CA was on his feet.
"Objection sustained," said the judge as he stared down at Lampkin, egging him on, really. "What is your point, Mr. Lampkin?"
"My point, Your Honor, is conflict of interest.
It is widely known that Dr. Scarpetta has an intimate relationship with at least one law enforcement individual she has worked cases with, and she has also influenced law enforcement, both the FBI and ATF, when it comes to her niece's career. I object. Overruled.
Please get to the point, Mr. Lampkin, said the judge as he reached for his water and goaded some more.
Thank you, Your Honor, Lampkin said with excruciating deference. What I'm trying to illustrate is an old pattern here.
The four whites and eight blacks sat politely in the jury box, staring back and forth from Lampkin to me as if they were watching a tennis match. Some of them were scowling. One was picking at a fingernail while another seemed asleep.
Dr. Scarpetta, isn't it true that you tend to manipulate situations to suit you?
I object! He's badgering the witness!
Overruled, the judge said. Dr. Scarpetta, please answer the question.
No, I absolutely do not tend to do that, I said with feeling, as I looked at the jurors.
Lampkin plucked a sheet of paper off the table where his felonious 19-year-old client sat.
According to this morning's newspaper, Lampkin hurried ahead, you've been manipulating law enforcement for years.
Your Honor, I object. This is outrageous.
Overruled, the judge coolly stated. It says right here in black and white that you have conspired with the FBI to send an innocent woman to the electric chair.
Lampkin approached the jurors and waved the photocopied article in their faces.
Your Honor, for God's sake! Exclaimed the C.A., sweating through his suit jacket.
Mr. Lampkin, please get on with your cross-examination, Judge Bowles said to the overweight, thick-necked Lampkin.
What I said about distance and trajectories and what vital organs had been struck by 10-millimeter bullets was a blur. I could scarcely remember a word of it after I hurried down the courthouse steps and walked swiftly without looking at anyone. Two tenacious reporters followed me for half a block and finally turned back when they realized it was easier to talk to a stone. The unfairness of what had happened in the witness stand went beyond words. Carrie had needed to fire but one small round, and already I was wounded. I knew this would not end. When I unlocked the back door to my building, for an instant the glare of sunlight made it hard for me to see as I stepped inside the cool, shaded bay. I opened the door leading inside and was relieved to see Fielding in the corridor, heading toward me. He was wearing fresh scrubs, and I supposed another case had come in. "Everything under control?" I asked, tucking my sunglasses inside my pocketbook.
"A suicide from Powhatan. 15-year-old girl shot herself in the head. It seems Daddy wouldn't let her see her dirtbag boyfriend anymore. You look terrible, Kay.
It's called a shark attack."
"Uh-oh. Damn fucking lawyers. Who was it this time?"
"He was ready to beat somebody up."
"Lampkin?" "Oh, good old Lamprey the Eel." Fielding squeezed my shoulder.
"It's gonna be all right. Trust me, it really will be. You just gotta block out the bullshit and go on."
"I know," I smiled at him.
"I'll be in the decomp room if you need me." The solitary task of patiently working on bones was a welcome relief, for I did not want anyone on my staff to detect my dejection and fear. I switched on lights and shut the door behind me. I tied a gown over my clothes and pulled on two layers of latex gloves and turned on the electric burner and took the lid off the pot. The bones had continued processing after I had left last night, and I probed them with a wooden spoon. I spread a plasticized sheet over a table. The skull had been sawn open during autopsy, and I carefully lifted the dripping calvarium and the bones of the face with its calcined teeth from tepid, greasy water. I set them on the sheet to drain. I preferred wooden tongue depressors versus plastic spatulas to scrape tissue from bone. Metal instruments were out of the question because they would cause damage that might obviate our finding true marks of violence. I worked very carefully, loosening and defleshing while the rest of the skeletal remains quietly cooked in their steamy pot. For 2 hours I cleaned and rinsed until my wrists and fingers ached. I missed lunch and, in fact, never thought of it. At almost 2 p.m., I found a nick in the bone beneath the temporal region where I had found hemorrhage, and I stopped and stared in disbelief. I pulled surgical lamps closer, blasting the table with light. The cut to bone was straight and linear, no more than an inch in length, and so shallow it easily could have been missed. The only time I had ever seen an injury similar to this was in the 19th century skulls of people who had been scalped. In those instances, the nicks or cuts were not generally associated with temporal bone, but that meant nothing, really. Scalping was not an exact surgical procedure, and anything was possible. Although I had found no evidence that the Warrenton victim was missing areas of scalp and hair, I could not swear to it. Certainly, when we had found her, the head was not intact. And while the scalping trophy might involve most of the cranium, it might also mean the excision of a single lock of hair. I used a towel to pick up the phone because my hands were unfit to touch anything clean. I paged Marino. For 10 minutes I waited for him to call back while I continued to carefully scrape. But I found no other marks. This did not mean, of course, that additional injury had not been lost, for at least a third of the 22 bones of the skull were burned away. My mind raced through what I should do. I yanked off my gloves and threw them in the trash, and I was flipping through an address book I had gotten out of my purse when Marino called. "Where the hell are you?" I asked, as stress gushed toxins through my body.
"At Liberty Valance, eating."
"Thank you for getting back to me so quickly," I irritably said. "Gee, Doc, it must have been lost in space somewhere because I just got it. What the shit's going on?" I could hear the background noise of people drinking and enjoying food that was guaranteed to be greasy and deadly but worth it. "Are you on a payphone?" I asked. "Yeah, and I'm off duty, just so you know." He took a swallow of something that I figured was beer. "I've got to get to Washington tomorrow. Something significant has come up."
"Uh-oh, I hate it when you say that."
"I found something else."
"You gonna tell me, or do I have to stay up all night pacing?"
He had been drinking, and I did not want to talk to him about this now. "Listen, can you go with me, assuming Dr. Vesey can see us?
The bones man at the Smithsonian?"
"I'll call him at home as soon as we get off the phone."
"I'm off tomorrow, so I guess I can squeeze you in."
I did not say anything as I stared at the simmering pot and turned the heat down just a little.
"Point is, count me in," Marino said, swallowing again.
"Meet me at my house," I said. "At 9.
I'll be there with bells on."
Next, I tried Dr. Vesey's Bethesda home, and he answered on the first ring.
"Thank God," I said.
"Alex, it's Kay Scarpetta."
Oh, well, how are you?"
He was always a bit befuddled and missing in action in the minds of the hoi polloi who did not spend their lives putting people back together again. Dr. Vesey was one of the finest forensic anthropologists in the world, and he had helped me many times before. "I'll be much better if you tell me you're in town tomorrow," I said.
"I'll be working on the railroad, as always."
"I've got a cut mark on a skull. I need your help. Are you familiar with the Warrenton fire?"
"Can't be conscious and not know about that."
"Okay, then you understand."
"I won't be there until about 10, and there's no place to park," he said. "I got in a pig's tooth the other day with aluminum foil stuck in it," he absently went on about whatever he'd been doing of late. "I guess from a pig roast dug up in someone's backyard. The Mississippi coroner thought it was a homicide. Some guy shot in the mouth."
He coughed and loudly cleared his throat. I heard him drink something.
"Still getting bear paws now and then," he went on. "More coroners thinking they're human hands."
"I know, Alex," I said. "Nothing has changed." 8. Marino pulled into my driveway early at 9:15 because he wanted coffee and something to eat. He was officially not working, so he was dressed in blue jeans, a Richmond Police t-shirt, and cowboy boots that had lived a full life. He had slicked back what little hair had weathered his years, and he looked like an old beer-bellied bachelor about to take his woman to Billy Bob's.
"Are we going to a rodeo?" I asked as I let him in. "You know, you always have a way of pissing me off."
He gave me a sour look that didn't faze me in the least. He didn't mean it.
"Well, I think you look pretty cool," as Lucy would say. "I've got coffee and granola."
"How many times do I gotta tell you that I don't eat friggin' birdseed?"
he grumbled as he followed me through my house.
"And I don't cook steak egg biscuits."
"Well, maybe if you did, you wouldn't spend so many evenings alone."
"I hadn't thought about that."
This book is continued on Disc 5.